Hey, Leo here for actualized.org. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about correcting the stigma around psychedelics. Life lived in the absence of the psychedelic experience is life trivialized, life denied, life enslaved to the ego. A quote by Terence McKenna. This is going to be a in-depth, multi-part series aimed at addressing the issue of this stigma that surrounds the field of psychedelics and to educate people about this field. And it's really quite a remarkable and amazing field that we've only just begun to explore. In this episode, I'm not going to focus on talking about my own trip reports. I've talked about that in the past, and I will in the future, but not here. And I'm not going to talk about how to trip or the proper protocol for which psychedelics to do or all the mystical experiences that psychedelics can lead towards. That's not what we're interested in here. I just want to lay the foundation for this field because it's an interesting field, and most people don't realize that it's a field. And there's this huge gaping hole in our education system, which teaches nothing at all about this field. It doesn't teach about the historical context. It doesn't teach about the anthropology. It doesn't teach about the botany of it. It doesn't teach about the chemistry of it. It doesn't teach about the psychology, the psychiatry, the clinical and medical studies, and a lot of new science that's being done. This is a really cutting-edge field that a lot of people, I think, underestimate. And the reason that is because our culture has this giant stigma around psychedelics. As soon as you bring up the word, people immediately associate it with drugs, and then they dismiss you, or they demonize you, or they think you've gone on the deep end, or they think you're a hippie, or any one of these kind of stereotypes. And this is really unwarranted, and I want to show you that this is the case. Now, maybe I'm preaching to the choir. Some of you already are on board with me with psychedelics, but really I was quite surprised when I started to release my psychedelic videos about a year or so ago. I got a pretty big backlash from my followers, and people would leave me comments, and they still leave me comments to this day about my stance on psychedelics. And really what happened with me is that I started experimenting with them. I really wasn't into drugs at all. I wasn't into psychedelics at all. It was just something that I stumbled upon in my research. Because the thing that I'm interested in is personal development and reality, and so I'm always researching new stuff. And my stance on psychedelics before I tried them was basically one of the common masses. Because you know what? I was raised in the same education system and by the same culture that many people who denounce psychedelics have been raised in. And our education system is really hell-bent on keeping kids away from drugs. And this was programmed into my mind from a very early age, as it probably was for you if you grew up in the United States, or I'm not sure how it is in other countries, but I'm sure that there are similar types of programs and drugs on war that goes on here in the US, which also happen in Europe and in Asia or wherever else around the world in westernized first world countries that are rather modern. But as we shall see throughout this series, is that actually almost all of the negativity around psychedelics comes from just downright ignorance on the people, even the people who are teaching this stuff in school. They just don't know. The fact is, these people who are anti-psychedelics, they haven't actually done them. They haven't actually tried them. And they are so hell-bent on their beliefs about psychedelics without having any direct experience of it, that this leads to all sorts of absurdities. And where we're at now in our culture is that the education system and what it teaches about psychedelics is anti-scientific, it's anti-medical, it's anti-psychological, it's anti-historical, and really it's anti-human, as you will see, and we're going to build the case for that. This episode is going to be filled with a lot of evidence and facts. What I want to do here with this series is just to present a lot of just basic facts, because there's this hole, like I said, right? And so people don't know the facts by not knowing the facts, by not having the historical context, by not seeing how psychedelics fit in with everything else that we do in culture, and also by not knowing the latest clinical and psychological studies that have been done just in the last 10 years. This is all cutting edge stuff. And this is going to completely change your mind, and it's going to dispel this stigma, because the reality is that not only are psychedelics not bad as they are stigmatized to be, but they are actually 180 degrees opposite. They're not just neutral, they're amazing. And they are very important for the development of the human race, and maybe perhaps for the survival of the human race. But that's difficult to appreciate before you really hear this case that I'm going to lay out for you, and then you actually go and try them for yourself. The reality is that in our society, in the West, we have flagrant propaganda coming from the government and from the business sector and from the from education and from our culture and even from our religions, from Judeo-Christian religions that are very conservative and orthodox, against psychedelics. And this propaganda is filled with lies and with dogma, and it's based on zero direct experience. So we're going to address all that here. But really, I shouldn't have been that surprised that there was a backlash, because you know what? Until I tried the psychedelics, I wasn't convinced myself. I was sort of closed-minded to it. But the thing that saved me from committing a great epistemic blunder here is that I actually listen to my own advice about epistemology, and I keep my mind open, and I listen to feedback, and I listen to comments, and I investigate, and I explore, and I question my own deepest held convictions and beliefs. And I know that just because I have an opinion about something doesn't mean squat until I actually go and try it out for myself. And that's what I did with psychedelics, and then that's what changed my mind. So, see, I was wrong, and I will continue to be wrong in the future, and there's other stuff I've been wrong about in the past. The key is not to be perfect all the time with your knowledge. You're never going to be perfect. Don't even try to be perfect with your pursuit of truth. The key is to have the right guiding principles so that you don't get stuck in your ignorance. Don't double down on your ignorance. That's the key mistake that people make. And that's the reason that I talk so much about epistemology. I talk about paradigms, paradigm locks, default positions, true versus false skepticism, belief systems, and all this sort of stuff. And the reason we do a lot of that here is because that's necessary to open your mind to break out of a lot of this kind of cultural conditioning that we're fed, not just about psychedelics, but about all sorts of stuff. And that's necessary for you to really become highly conscious in this world. It's not going to happen otherwise. What I want to do here is I want to start off the discussion by quoting from Terence McKenna again. I already quoted him at the beginning here, but he was a pioneer in this field, an early pioneer, and he was remarkable in his ability to articulate very elegantly and very concisely the core issues surrounding psychedelics. He was a psychonaut himself, and also a brilliant writer. So here's what he says about psychedelics. Quote, "Psychedelics are illegal not because a loving government is concerned that you may jump out of a third-story window. Psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally laid down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong." And he also says, quote, "Part of what psychedelics do is they decondition you from cultural values. This is what makes it such a hot political potato, a political hot potato. Since all culture is a kind of con game, the most dangerous candy you can hand out is one which causes people to start questioning the rules of the game." End quote. That's Terence McKenna. This, in a nutshell, is the reason that this stigma exists. And this is something we're going to explore later on in this series, in the second or third episode. I'm not sure how many episodes we're going to need here, because I need to present a lot of factual information to you. But we're going to get into the guts of why society likes to demonize psychedelics so much. It's not an accident. And Terrence McKenna tells us here why this is. So what we're going to cover in this series, here's a brief outline for you. We're going to give you a lot of historical context about how psychedelics were used throughout the last 10,000 years in human civilization, and that they played a much bigger role than is generally acknowledged. We're going to talk about the medical benefits and some of the amazing clinical studies and research that has been done, and how psychedelics can help with all sorts of issues from depression to anxiety to end of life and PTSD and so forth. We're going to talk about common misconceptions and myths about psychedelics, and we're going to dispel those. We're going to talk about why psychedelics are demonized, what's really behind that. And we're going to talk about the double standard that exists between other substances that are legalized in society, like alcohol, tobacco, opioids, and bad food. And then we're going to compare the risks of all of these with psychedelics so that we can put them into proper context and see whether making them illegal is really justified, as the government likes to proclaim. So that's our outline. Now, let's begin with understanding an important catch-22 about psychedelics. This is something that a lot of people who are just getting introduced to psychedelics or hearing about them for the first time don't fully appreciate, this catch-22. So here's what this is. This is this sort of circular logic which prevents people from opening their minds to psychedelics. And this catch-22 goes as follows. I come to you and I say, hey, psychedelics can transform your life. They really can. They could be some of the greatest experiences ever. And then you say, no, Leo, psychedelics are dangerous. They will damage my brain. They will give me hallucinations. They are just for recreation. They will lead me down the road to using hard drugs. And this whole thing is just a delusion. But where is that notion coming from? If you think about it, that notion is coming from your schooling, your education, and from culture at large. Where did you pick up that idea? It wasn't from direct experience with psychedelics. It was from culture. So you're depending and trusting on culture to be correct. Now, what I'm telling you here is that culture is incorrect. And in fact, you'll be shocked at how incorrect culture is. But the catch-22 is that you have to try psychedelics to discover this. And of course, when I tell you, hey, go try it, what do you say? You tell me, no, Leo, I'm not going to try it because it's gonna damage me. But the only reason you believe it damages you is because you're believing your culture. You see, so you're locked into this loop of circular logic. And the only way to break out is, well, there's two ways. One, and the most direct method, is to actually go try a psychedelic for yourself and do a scientific experiment and see. You can easily prove me wrong if I happen to be wrong by trying a psychedelic, and maybe it'll justify all your opinions about it. Or maybe the reverse will happen. What'll happen is the reverse. If you give psychedelics a good go. See, one of the problems people do is that they say, oh, well, Leo, I have tried psychedelics. When I was back in high school, you know, me and my buddies, we went to a rave and we got drunk and wasted and had some mushrooms. And I tried a little bit of that. And it was bad. I had hallucinations and a bad trip. And so now I have direct experience and I know that they're bad. No, see, that wasn't a proper evaluation of psychedelics. You did them when you were a kid, in a party setting, with alcohol, with a bunch of other nonsense. You didn't even know what you were taking, what the dosage was. You were not prepared. You were not mature. And so you experienced something that you can barely even remember. All you can remember is that it left a bad taste in your mouth. That's not the right way. If you do them responsibly, using the right protocol, at the right dose, in the right setting, with an open mind, and having the right context for what you're experiencing. That means doing some research, reading some books, listening to me, talk about non-duality and spirituality, learning about these things, have that background foundation in place, then you will see that what I'm saying is very much true. And one of the most incredible epiphanies you will have about psychedelics is that they will shatter your faith in culture and in society, which is precisely why they're so dangerous. And why culture and society doesn't like them. Yes, you can have amazing non-dual experiences. You can have experiences of God. You can have experiences of various deities and, and you can experience oneness and connection with the world. You can also self-reflect in a very deep way, and you can do real growth, accomplish real personal development by getting to the bottom of your addictions, your neuroses, your bad behaviors, your anxieties, and your hang-ups, and your limiting beliefs. They can help you with all that sort of stuff. You can heal yourself both physically and psychologically with psychedelics, but, and all those will be huge revelations, but perhaps not as much as the revelation that everything that culture has told you about psychedelics is 180 degrees wrong. It's the exact opposite. It's almost as though the devil got a hold of this field of psychedelics and turned it inside out to serve his purpose of maintaining the status quo. Might that just be an accident? Or might there be something a little bit more deeper to that? If you watch my Devil episode, then maybe you'll know. So that's the catch-22. So you have to be very careful here not to reason in a circle, but to really be honest with yourself, very objective, and to say, okay, this guy's telling me that there's information that I don't know about, there's studies I don't know about, and that society has lied to me about this stuff. And to be honest, I don't have a direct experience of what he's talking about, so I have to keep an open mind. He might be wrong, but maybe he's right. See? And maybe he's not just right, and that's just, okay, fine, he's right. But it's like, he's right, and this information could transform my entire life forever. You see? That's why this topic is so important. It's precisely because of the potential that this topic has for transforming you and everyone around you and all of society. And this is something that we need more than ever now in the 21st century. So the substances, just to be very clear and specific, that we're going to be talking about here and calling psychedelics are going to be things like DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, LSD, mescaline, psilocybin or magic mushrooms, iboga, salvia divinorum, MDMA, or otherwise known as ecstasy. These are all in this category. I'm not really going to be talking about pot or weed or marijuana. You could call it a psychedelic or you could not. I mean, edible pot is actually quite hallucinogenic, but generally smoking pot is not nearly as powerful as a true psychedelic. And it's really in a sort of separate category. But what we need to do is we need to make a very clear distinction between all of these substances that I just talked about and heroin, cocaine, crack, and meth, quaaludes, and any other kind of weird hard drugs that exist out there. These here are recreational drugs, and they need to be very clearly distinguished from psychedelics. And see, one of the first mistakes, or actually maybe it's not a mistake, that our culture has made is lumping all of these together into one category. In our education system, we tend to treat all this stuff as just drugs, and not just in our education system, but even legally. The DEA, the U.S. federal government, classifies DMT and LSD and psilocybin as Schedule I substances, the exact same category as heroin, cocaine, and crack. Believe it or not, meth, from what I can recall, if my memory serves me correct, meth is actually Schedule II. So the federal government says that DMT and LSD and psilocybin is worse than meth, which, if you have any experience with this field, just goes to show you how ridiculous that is. There's a lot of ridiculous things in the DEA guidelines. But we'll talk more about that later. But anyways, see, our education system, and I can understand where it's coming from, it has lumped all these things together. Because our education system, its number one priority is what? It's not the spiritual evolution of mankind or of our kids. It's not higher consciousness. Consciousness is not even taught in school. You can go to school for 12 years, you will not hear the word consciousness. Let alone all the stuff that goes into it, all the subtleties of it. Nor will you hear the word personal development. Our school system has lumped all this together because our school system's number one priority is just to give kids the basics they need to have a job and to not be homeless and to have a little bit of education and to not get sidetracked and to not become heroin junkies. And that's good. Nothing wrong with that. Of course, we don't want kids becoming heroin junkies. And so, of course, we tend to lean towards the side or err in the side of caution. And we tend to say, well, just keep kids away from drugs entirely. We don't want to split hairs too much about this stuff. But see, damage is done there. Because in this sort of sloppy black and white way of thinking, we really fail to see a big difference between these kind of substances and why they're used and how they're used and what their potential is. See, heroin doesn't have the potential to enlighten you. Heroin doesn't have the potential to make you a more self-aware human being, whereas DMT and LSD do. And heroin is extremely addictive, whereas LSD and DMT are not addictive at all. And that's something we'll cover more as well. So we need to make this very clear distinction here. Otherwise, this whole field gets muddied up. And anytime people talk about psychedelics, those who are not in the know just hear it as drugs. It's like, oh, Leo, you're talking about drugs. You're just doing drugs. You're just justifying your use of drugs. Actually, I'm very anti-drugs. Not only am I anti-heroin and cocaine and meth and all this sort of stuff, but I'm even anti-alcohol and anti-smoking and tobacco and anti-prescription drugs. And I'm anti-eating sugar and drinking soda and caffeine. I don't even consume caffeine. I mean, I do a little green tea, so that technically has caffeine in it, but I don't like guzzle down coffee or any of this kind of stuff, right? So I actually carry my dislike for drugs over into a lot of other fields. To me, there's no distinction really between drugs and, for example, television or reading tabloid magazines or getting addicted to pornography or getting addicted to the internet. Or getting addicted to greasy food. To me, all this stuff is just addiction. And then there's different degrees of it. And psychedelics are really a whole nother ballgame. Now, let's start by talking about the very deep historical context here to put all this into perspective, to see the big picture. What you got to understand here, and this is, again, something that's not taught in school at all, is that you can find psychedelic plants by the dozens and hundreds on every single continent in the world. Every single culture. From the beginning of prehistory, we have evidence that they have partaken of psychedelics. And this is what I want to show you a lot of evidence for. It's really quite mind-blowing when you start to study this stuff, because none of this stuff is talked about anywhere. You don't see this on the evening news. This isn't talked about in magazines, mostly. This isn't talked about by your family, by your coworkers. It's not taught in school. So where else would you get this information other than that if you were interested and you actually went and did this open-minded research? See, what you got to understand is that human beings for about 10,000 years have been living in cities and building civilizations. But before that, we were hunter-gatherers. And as hunter-gatherers, we relied on our environment to live. This was a matter of survival. This was a matter of natural selection and evolution. This was serious stuff. These days, we live in our comfortable cities, and we're very disconnected from nature. We're disconnected from the stars. We don't even see them in our cities. We're disconnected from the earth. We're disconnected from building shelters, from hunting animals, from gathering berries and mushrooms and identifying plants. When you take this into account, you realize that actually herbalism was one of the earliest sciences that man developed before there ever was a notion of science. Herbalism is the science of distinguishing, making fine distinctions between all sorts of different kinds of plants and the environment that you're living in, because we lived in forests and we lived in savannas and grasslands and we lived in jungles. So no matter where we lived or even in the deserts, there were critical plants to our survival there. And these early herbalists or medicine men, they would go out there and they would have to test through trial and error and at great peril and danger and risk all these plants personally by taste testing them on other people, and seeing all the survival benefits that could be gleaned from herbalism. So they had to go out there and they had to learn which berries we could eat, which mushrooms are edible, which ones will kill you, which vines we can cut open and get water from, which leaves we could rub on our wounds to cure an infection, or which flowers we could brew to make a tea to help with an upset stomach, or to cure the plague, or to help with pregnancy, you see, or to stop bleeding. So these were very serious matters. And if you take a look at modern surviving native tribes, hunter-gatherer-like tribes, which live in Africa, which live in Aboriginal Australia, which live in the Amazonian rainforests, basically all over the world, in Indonesia, these types of tribes exist, you can see that these people are very, very reliant on herbs and plant life, also animal life, of course, too, their knowledge of it and their very fine distinctions of it in order to survive. Which is the exact opposite of us today in modern cultures. And as modern cultures, we like to think that, oh, well, we're the sophisticated ones. They're just like savages, primitives living in the forest, running around naked with a loincloth, or even less. But the more you start to study these savages and these primitives, you realize that actually they have a lot of wisdom and intelligence. And they're also very spiritual people. And also you start to study them and you see, oh, these guys don't have things like depression or anxiety. See, they don't have suicide. They don't have heart disease epidemics. They don't have ADHD problems with their kids. You see, so you start to see that and say, hey, maybe they're the intelligent ones and we're the backwards ones. Maybe we have it 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Maybe the devil is playing a trick on us. That's an interesting possibility. And it just makes perfectly logical sense that 10,000 years ago, even 100,000 years ago, our ancestors would be experimenting with every possible plant that was in their environment. And we even see primitive, very primitive notions of herbalism at work in our cats and dogs. If you have a cat or a dog who is sick, you can see them go. I had a cat once, and she would go when she was sick. She would actually nibble on some grass, some blades of grass that grew outside, and that would help her to purge and to get any bad food out of her system. See, that was a very primitive form of herbalism. But of course, us humans, we took it to the next level because we're much more resourceful than that. So let me show you some of the evidence for this. And it's really quite remarkable. I'm going to be flashing a lot of images here for you as I'm speaking. These will be images of various cave art and Egyptian hieroglyphics and all sorts of interesting examples that we see from history. So first, what I have for you is I have one of the earliest known clear depictions of psychedelic use in primitive cultures. This is from a cave in modern-day Algeria. This cave is called the Tassili Agir Cave. And there in that cave, there's this picture of what looks like a bee shaman. I call him a bee shaman because he looks like he's wearing sort of a bee mask in the striped suit. And this shaman is holding mushrooms in his hands and has mushrooms growing all around his body. Very, very clear. What you see here is you're going to see two images. You're going to see one image of the original cave painting, which is a bit worn out. It's kind of hard to make sense of it. And then you're going to see a much clearer and sharper pencil sketch of the original cave painting. Guess how old this is? This cave painting has been dated to be 9,000 or 6,000 BC. So there's a big gap there because the radiocarbon dating is not perfect, but it's 9,000 to 6,000 BC plus add 2,000 years of AD to that, which means that this is an 11 to 8,000 year old cave painting. And already we have this very clear use of psychedelic mushrooms. We also have examples of psychedelic use within ancient Egypt. And you better believe that ancient Egypt was not just your ordinary civilization. They weren't just like us. They weren't just concerned about commerce and living ordinary lives. They were a very spiritual culture, very clearly. And they invested a lot of their resources towards spirituality. And that was not just primitive beliefs. That was something deeper. When you start to study ancient Egypt, it's really quite amazing what you start to find there. And especially if you've done some psychedelics and you can connect some of these dots. So what you'll see here, I'll show you a picture of this ancient Egyptian, what's called the Tree of Life. They call this the Tree of Life. This was a spiritual symbol for them. This was very important in their culture. And what this Tree of Life was the Acacia nilotica. I also want to show you a picture here of the actual acacia plant. It's a tree or like a giant shrub, this bush. And what's special about acacia is that it contains high concentrations of DMT and minute concentrations of 5-MeO-DMT. Now, this acacia bush is quite prevalent all around the world. It's found in South America, it's found in Europe, it's found in the Middle East, it's found in Africa, I believe. And there's a lot of varieties of this acacia. Mimosa trees, acacia, these are all in the same category. And all of them contain various degrees of DMT. Now, is it an accident that the Egyptians revered the acacia tree out of all the trees? You know, why didn't they revere the palm tree? Why wasn't a palm tree the tree of life, but rather the acacia bush? After all, there's not much special about the acacia tree. It doesn't look very special. It looks like a bush. If you wanted to revere a magnificent tree, you could find better trees. You could find oak trees, palm trees, and all sorts of stuff like that, which is much more grand to look at, but perhaps not as psychedelic. So what we are theorizing here, and we don't know this for sure, but there's a pretty good chance that the Egyptians tested out this acacia in all its various forms, eating it, grinding it, turning it into powders, turning it into concoctions, brewing it, steeping it, fermenting it, and smoking it, and all the other things, combining it with all sorts of other stuff, just to see what kind of properties it has. And there's a good chance they stumble upon its DMT effects. We're not sure exactly how, but that's a little speculative. But since they worship this tree, it's not that far out of the realm of speculation, especially when you take into account the other things that I will cite to you here in a little bit. Other examples of the acacia that's been used in other cultures. So it's not just limited to Egypt. But while we're on the topic of Egypt, let me mention the blue lotus. Here's some pictures of the blue lotus, and I want to show you the actual picture of the lotus as it exists in the lily fields in the water, but also how the Egyptians depicted it. Because the Egyptians also revered the blue lotus. You can see it in a lot of their temple paintings and in their hieroglyphic, I guess you would call them reliefs, where they show this blue lotus being picked and being used and being revered. And the blue lotus, while it's not a very powerful psychedelic, you're not going to trip balls on it, but it does put you into a sort of dreamy-like trance state. It does warp your consciousness a little bit, and it actually has strong aphrodisiac qualities, and they would use it for their Egyptian orgies. And we actually have a picture here of a classic Egyptian orgy, and you can see the blue lotus flower above the head of the woman who is having sex with the man. Every depiction of the woman has a little blue lotus flower over her head, which I've pointed out with red arrows. So that's very interesting. Also, interestingly, the classic poems of the Iliad and the Odyssey. If you remember the Odyssey, if you read that in high school or something, then you remember towards the end of the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men, they land on the island of the Lotus Eaters. And the Lotus Eaters basically are people who get stuck on that island and they eat these lotuses on the island. These lotuses just send them into this delightful trance, and they never want to leave the island again. They get entranced for life, and they get enslaved by this lotus. Well, that pretty well describes what the blue lotus is like, although it's an exaggeration of it. And we know that ancient Greece and Rome were very, very strongly influenced by the prior civilization of Egypt. So it makes perfect sense that Homer would have adopted that tale from maybe stories that he heard about how the Egyptians used the blue lotus. And of course, the Egyptians probably used it for sex and for festivals and for parties and for banquets and for all sorts of fun stuff. Not necessarily in spiritual uses, but maybe also in spiritual uses too. Probably a combination, actually. Because in these primitive cultures, there were these sharp distinctions between recreation and festivals and spirituality. All this stuff was holistically combined together in a seamless way. Also, we have the story of Moses from the Old Testament. And of course, you know the classic story of Moses, where he sees the burning bush, and the burning bush is God speaking to Moses, giving him signs, which leads him to go on and to lead his people and to found Israel and to really advance Judaism. Well, what happened there? What is the burning bush? The burning bush in the Old Testament is none other than the acacia tree. That's what it was supposed to be. So was it an accident? Did Moses just, was he just walking along the side of the road and just happened to bump into a burning bush? Maybe. Or maybe what happened was that these ancient peoples knew about acacia, knew about the DMT and the spiritual effects, and that they actually had rituals for burning this bush, for smoking it, for inhaling the fumes, maybe for mixing it into concoctions with other stuff. And that's where this idea of the burning bush came from. On the other side of the globe, we have Chile and Argentina, where they have found archaeological evidence of snuffing pipes for snorting yopo seeds. Yopo seeds come from a tree which is actually similar looking to acacia. They have these pods, these long pods. In these pods are seeds. You can break them out. They're very flat looking. You can see a picture of it here. And these yopo seeds can be ground into a fine powder, mixed with snail shells and soda in order to give it the right consistency and texture. And then it can be snorted, very powerfully snorted up your nose. And these natives, they still do it to this day. This is a classic ritual that they have. These yopo seeds, they contain DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, and bufotenin in various percentages. And we have evidence of these snuffing pipes with trace amounts of this yopo, which go back to 2130 BC. And you can find videos and images of these natives, which still have these practices to this day. They take these long pipes, fill them full of a lot of yopo, and then they just, one native will blast it. You have to actually like a blow dart, blast it into the nose of the other native. And it's just this powerful shock that just blows up your nose, because you need a lot of this yopo in order to get the full effects, because it's not very pure. The concentration is not very high. So they need to like stuff a gram of that stuff up your nose, which is not easy to do. We also have evidence from that part of the world, from Peru, for example, of very early use of the San Pedro cactus, which contains mescaline. And we have evidence of this dating back to 8,600 BC through to 5,600 BC. So in that range is the earliest use of peyote there that's been found. I mean, not peyote, but San Pedro. Peyote is the next one I want to tell you about. That's also a cactus that's found in the Americas, especially in the Mexico region and in the southwestern U.S. region. And the earliest peyote use that has been found is in Shumla Cave on the Rio Grande River in Texas. And this has been carbon dated to 3,780 BC to 3,660 BC. And these peyote buttons were so well preserved that scientists were actually able to take them and to do an alkaloid extraction, and they were surprised that they were able to get almost as much of the active ingredient from peyote, the mescaline, as they were from modern-day peyote buttons. And these were 5,000-year-old peyote buttons, and they were still psychoactive after 5,000 years. That's quite remarkable. And of course, peyote ceremonies are a classic ritual that is done by Native American tribes throughout the U.S., and they are still done to this day. And the Native tribes in the U.S. actually have a legal right to do that because they have sort of different laws that govern them than American citizens. Another interesting example that I found is from Scotland. There's an ancient archaeological site there called Skara Brae, which is being excavated. And there what they found evidence of is not psychedelics so much as they found this hallucinogenic alcohol. They actually found an alcohol that was brewed out of wheat, but it wasn't ordinary alcohol. It also contained very powerful and downright deadly psychoactive plants like henbane, hemlock, and belladonna. And these plants can kill you, but they're not so much psychedelic as they are like delirients. But those were infused into this alcohol. And evidence of this alcohol, this psychedelic alcohol, dates back to 3180 BC to 2500 BC. And you can see a picture here of the excavation of Skara Brae. So the Scotlanders knew how to really party and how to get drunk with the right kind of alcohol, not the weak, piddly stuff that we serve today. Speaking of which, we also have very compelling evidence from Greeks and Romans that their alcohol was also this kind of hallucinogenic alcohol. They talk about wine a lot in Greek and Roman stories and tales, and we know that they drank a lot of wine. But what's also very interesting about that wine is that we tend to assume that it was just like regular wine, just grape juice, right? Well, not quite so fast, because the Greeks and Romans write about tales where men would go drunk and blind and mad, even could kill themselves by drinking too much wine. And you would think, well, how could they get so drunk just from regular wine? Especially since the Greeks and Romans did not drink pure concentrated wine. They always watered their wine down significantly. 50 or 80% of their wine was diluted with water. So how could you get mad drunk or even kill yourself on that kind of diluted wine? Well, maybe it wasn't ordinary wine. And we know this because wine can only have up to 15% alcohol content. In fact, it's impossible to produce a hard spirit like vodka or Everclear or rum or gin or any of these very high-proof kind of alcohols. It's impossible to produce them without the process of distillation. Through fermentation, you can only get it up to about 15%. And after that, it peaks. So you need to invent distillation. When was distillation invented? It was invented in the late Middle Ages, in the early Renaissance era in southern Italy, in Europe. So we know for a fact that the Greeks and Romans did not have distillation. So what that leads us to believe, and there's other evidence for this, is that they infused their alcohol, just like the Scotlanders did thousands of years before them, with perhaps mushrooms, henbane, hemlock, and who knows what other kind of herbs existed. There are so many psychoactive herbs in the world, it's mind-blowing. In fact, what I want to do, I brought my book, The Encyclopedia of Psychoactive Plants. Now, to really appreciate this, you got to feel how heavy this book is. This thing is a true encyclopedia. It probably weighs around 5 pounds. You could kill someone with this book. And it's just got pages and pages of pages of every single plant that has any kind of psychoactive properties whatsoever on the planet that we know of. And that's only that we know of. There's a lot that we don't know of yet. This just goes to show you how much stuff they could have possibly been infusing into this alcoholic beverage. Also, speaking of the Greeks and Romans, we have the Eleusinian Mysteries. I've spoken about this in the past. This is a really remarkable thing. The Eleusinian Mysteries was a religious cult or sect that existed, which was very, very popular in ancient Roman Greece. And it lasted all the way to the demise of the Roman Empire in 500 AD. But it lasted for 2,000 years before that. So this goes back to 1,500 BC. And the Eleusinian Mysteries was this religious rite, this temple in Eleusis, where all the Greeks and Romans would gather. They would go there and they would drink this substance called the kakion. This substance was made out of fermented wheat, but of course not just wheat. It also had some kind of psychedelic effect. And the some researchers have done a lot of research on this, trying to figure out, you know, what could have been the active ingredient in this kakion, because the Greeks and Romans who took this drink talked about having ecstatic visions of spirits and deities and all sorts of religious experiences. So it was clearly a very powerful drink, not just fermented wheat. There was something more to it, a secret ingredient. What was that secret ingredient? Well, it's thought to be ergot. Ergot is a fungus, a deadly fungus that grows on wheat. You'll see a picture here of what ergotized wheat looks like. Usually, when you have ergot on wheat, it can be deadly. So it's very important that if you're growing a lot of wheat, which of course the Greeks and Romans did, and the Egyptians did, is you have to be careful with not consuming this ergotized wheat with this fungus on it, because if you do, it could actually kill you. There's examples of where people got killed by it, or they actually go insane or crazy. It's a very toxic fungus. But what is hypothesized by researchers is that the Greeks and Romans could have learned a method for how to distill the alkaloids from this ergot substance, because ergot is actually how LSD is made out of. So modern LSD is synthesized from ergot. But modern LSD requires very complicated lab equipment to create. You can't just do it in your home, and the Greeks and Romans probably didn't have that technology, but they could have found some kind of primitive way to extract the good stuff and then basically put it into their fermented wheat drink, their kakion, and then basically what they had is liquid LSD drink. And if you've tried LSD, you know how powerful that can be, even in very tiny doses. So it seems like the Greeks and Romans caught on to that pretty early, and they were using this drink, this kakion, in the Eleusinian Mysteries for 2,000 years. And this was one of the most important rituals that all the big-name Greeks and Romans partook in. Emperors drank this drink at these rituals. Important philosophers like Plato and Aristotle participated in this. Other writers like Cicero and maybe Plutarch. So there's examples of these people participating in these Eleusinian Mysteries. So this was quite popular with the aristocrats in Greece and Rome. This wasn't just something that was like a little known cult. This was a big thing. It was a cult, but it was a big cult, and it lasted for a very long time. Of course, in the Indian subcontinent, we have evidence for a lot of different psychedelic use as well. And one of the oldest texts that we have surviving in human history is the Vedas, the Hindu Vedas. And there in particular, they have the Rig Veda, which praises this psychedelic substance or drink, this concoction called soma. What exactly soma is, we don't know. It's speculated that it could have been the Amanita muscaria mushroom or psychedelic magic mushrooms, or maybe a combination of various kinds of herbs and psychoactive plants that we don't know, that has been lost to history. But this soma is mentioned as a sacred and revered drink, and the Vedas, especially the Rig Veda, all of this, there's a rich tradition there of spirituality and mysticism, which is directly related to that. And this goes back to 1500 to 1200 BC. Very old. Also, we have Freemasonry. Freemasonry is a lot misunderstood in popular culture today, but it traces its roots back all the way to ancient Egypt. And one of the symbols, Freemasonry has a lot of symbolic language that they use. One of the symbols they use frequently is the acacia branch. You'll see a picture of it here. And of course, you're familiar with the acacia. So why did the Freemasons revere and symbolize the acacia branch so much? Well, it stands for liberation and for freedom. and for spirituality and for truth. In certain cultures, it's called the tree of truth or the vine of truth. That would be ayahuasca, is the vine of truth. They call that one too. Then if we go to South America again, into Mexico, we have the Aztecs and we have the Mayans. And there we have evidence from the conquistadors when the Spanish invaders came to conquer the Aztecs and the Mayans. They ran across Teonanacatl, which literally translates in the Aztec language as the god mushroom. And these Spanish conquistadors, they discovered these Aztecs participating in these mushroom rituals. And also the Mayans participated in mushroom rituals. And here I'll show you some pictures of the Mayan mushroom stones, which are these sacred carvings, which clearly depict mushrooms. And also with the Mayans, very interestingly, is that they did mushroom enemas. And you can see that. I'll show you a couple of pictures here of Mayan reliefs and carvings with mushroom enemas depicted. So you can see these guys were not shy about their botany. They would stick these plants in every orifice that they could just to see what kind of effects they could have. Quite amazing. Of course, if we go further down in South America, we see the Amazon region has a rich tradition of psychedelic use, including ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is the vine of the gods, the vine of truth. It's this vine which is cut and then mixed with mimosa leaves and bark, and all this is put into a stew, and it's all brewed together, and then this drink, this nasty drink comes out of it that you drink, and then this sends you onto very, very deep psychedelic trips. And that, of course, is very popularly still done today. It's done there by the natives, and actually there's a whole tourism industry of Americans and Westerners going to Peru and into Brazil and the Amazon and doing this ayahuasca, also doing that yopo that I told you about. But that's not all. We also have psychedelic lichens. In Iceland, for example, I recently learned about a psychedelic lichen. These lichens, they grow on the shores of Iceland on the rocks there. And certain lichens, if you pick them and then you actually can boil these stones with a lichen on top and then drink that stone juice, that will make you very, very stoned. And some of the trip reports from these Icelandic lichens say that it's one of the most powerful trips you can have, more powerful than LSD and DMT and some of the other stuff. And this is one that isn't very well known and requires a lot more research. We also have witchcraft. Of course, witchcraft is much misunderstood these days, but the witches really were women who were interested in astral projection and channeling and having spiritual visions and out-of-body experiences. And one of the ways in which they facilitated this is with flying ointments. And what is flying ointment? A flying ointment is fat, which has animal fat, which has been reduced down and mixed and spiced with various psychedelic and poisonous deliriant plants like henbane, mandrake, datura, belladonna, and possibly others, maybe psychedelic mushrooms. All that stuff is mixed into this cream, this ointment, and then this cream is rubbed on your temples. It's rubbed into your armpits, can be rubbed into your vaginal area, and then this actually gets soaked in, absorbed through your skin, and then this will give you hallucinations and visions and various spiritual experiences. It's helpful for channeling. It's helpful for lucid dreaming. It's helpful for out-of-body experiences and that sort of stuff. Of course, in ancient India, we have also evidence of the use of datura. The datura plant, which is used in witchcraft and flying ointments, was also used by ancient monks and yogis in India. And actually, there's sometimes depictions of Shiva, which is the main god of Hinduism, who represents nothingness, absolute nothingness, or ultimate enlightenment. Shiva's sacred plant is called the datura. And the datura is a very interesting deliriant. It's actually quite dangerous. It's potentially lethal. You definitely don't want to experiment with it at home. And it's not just going to give you hallucinations. This thing will make you flat out insane, mad, like stark raving mad for weeks. This stuff is really, really powerful. So you don't want to screw around with it. It's also poisonous. You have to prepare in a special way so you don't kill yourself. But there's evidence of this being used in ancient India. Sometimes you see depictions of Shiva with a datura flower in his crown. And the datura flower is a sort of white trumpet-like looking flower. Of course, in Siberia, we have the original shaman. The word shaman comes from the Siberian shaman, who were the Siberian medicine man. Their word shaman is the local word there for a medicine man. And the Siberian shaman are notorious for preferring to work with Amanita muscaria mushrooms. These are also poisonous mushrooms with the red caps and the white polka dots, which everyone has seen, but you probably haven't eaten or even known that you could have eaten them. But in that region of the world, these mushrooms can be eaten, and they have psychoactive properties. They also have delirium qualities to them. They're also poisonous if you don't eat them properly. And so what the Siberian shaman would do is that he would actually eat the mushrooms himself. Then he would urinate out into a cup or a dish, and then he would serve his urine to all his followers, all his initiates, and they would drink his urine. Why is that? Because his body would process all the toxic delirium stuff from the Amanita muscaria, and then he would pee out the more pure psychedelic chemical substances. It doesn't actually deteriorate through your digestive system. He would pee it out, and then his followers could drink that urine with the more pure Amanita muscaria compounds in it without the toxins. He would be like the filter for the toxins. He would take one for the team, quite literally. And then they would drink it, and then they would have their trippy experiences. Of course, we shouldn't forget Africa. In West Central Africa, to this day, exists the Bwiti native tribe. And these Bwiti rely on a very, very powerful psychoactive called iboga. It's actually a root bark that they gather from this tree, small tree, like a bush. And then you can grind up this root bark and then you can ingest it. And iboga is a potentially lethal psychedelic, but it's also very, very powerful. It'll knock you off your feet. You won't be able to walk for days. It lasts for like 42 hours or even more. And it gives you very, very powerful spiritual visions. And this is part of the Bwiti's spiritual tradition to this day. They do these ceremonies. Not only do they do these ceremonies, this is their rite of passage for young men. They give it to their young men. They give them a lot of this iboga, so much that it almost kills them. And they go into this deep trance. They go through this whole ordeal. They come out of this experience completely changed. And then from that on, from that point on, they're considered adults and part of the adults in that tribe. So they give this to their teenagers. Very interesting. Of course, we also have evidence of hashish use. Hashish is like the flowers of the marijuana plant, which can be very potent. And we have evidence of that being used in ancient India. We have evidence of it being used in the Middle Ages in the Arab countries. In fact, we have the assassins. If you don't know where that word assassins comes from, it actually comes from the Arab assassins who would drink various kinds of powerful alcoholic beverages and would smoke hashish, and then they would use that to go out there into a fury and kill and murder people. That's where we get assassins from. Also, we have this plant called Syrian rue, which is prevalent in the Middle East, and Syrian rue has very mild psychoactive properties by itself, but it turns out to be one of the most powerful potentiators of other psychedelics. So, for example, if you take mushrooms, 2 grams of mushrooms, and you combine it with a gram of Syrian rue, the Syrian rue will transform your 2 grams of mushrooms into a 20-gram dose. 10 to 20 times as powerful just by sprinkling some Syrian rue in there. This is actually quite dangerous to do. You don't want to screw around with Syrian rue and other psychedelics just because it can potentiate them so much, so you want to be very careful. But actually, there are these combinations that you can make with Syrian rue and mushrooms and other stuff, which can take your trips to a whole new level. And the ancient tribes and peoples who live there knew about Syrian rue. Syrian rue also has the property of this deep red color. They would use Syrian rue to also dye their carpets and their rugs this bright, deep red. We also have the plant Salvia divinorum, which is native to the Mexico region, and the Mexicans have been using it and smoking it for spiritual purposes, probably for a while. We don't know for how long. Also, morning glory seeds are also found in that same exact area, and they all have also been used by natives of that region for tripping. And a very interesting plant that I think has a lot of potential is phalaris grass. Phalaris grass is this grass that you see here on the screen. I'm going to show you a picture of it. It's a very ordinary looking type of grass. But what's so special about it is it has very high concentrations of 5-MeO-DMT and also some amount of regular DMT as well. This phalaris grass grows in Europe, Asia, North Africa, and America. It's found almost on every continent. It's hard for me to imagine that native cultures to these areas who were growing up around this grass never fully appreciated its psychoactive properties. I would bet that they found ways to smoke it, to grind it, to extract it, to do whatever with it to get high, although we don't have any direct evidence from the archaeological record that I can show you on that. So that's the historical context. Hopefully you can start to see that psychedelics have been central to spirituality, to religion, and to civilization, and to human culture for the last, like, literally 50,000 years. We have cave paintings that go back 50,000 years ago, and there's speculation that these cave paintings might have actually been painted by people on psychedelics, because there's a lot of trippy stuff depicted on these cave paintings. So this could have been the origins of civilization. It could have been the origin of human art. It almost certainly was the seeds or the catalyst for human spirituality and mysticism, and that ultimately led to religion. Of course, I'm not saying that psychedelics were the only cause. I'm not saying that spirituality can only be done through psychedelics. That's not true at all. I do not believe in Terence McKenna's stoned ape theory. He had this theory that, basically humans became conscious and fully human because of their use of psychedelics. I don't know if I buy that completely, but I do think that psychedelics played a key role in catalyzing spirituality and mainstream religion. Because the reason I don't believe in the stoned ape theory is because you don't need psychedelics to have a very deep spiritual experience. If you just sit down and practice certain breathing techniques, certain relaxation techniques, certain focusing and visualization techniques with your mind, like is done in yoga and many other mystical traditions, you can have all these experiences. You can channel, you can go out of body, you can do astral projection, all this sorts of interesting stuff without an ounce of psychedelics. But I think the psychedelics make it a lot quicker, a lot more effective, and a lot easier to distribute through a culture. It's a lot easier to just give someone some mushroom and then have them experience exactly what you're talking about, rather than having to invent a language and to work through trying to explain something that's really not explainable in words. So I think that that's really where they played the crucial part. Of course, we also need to talk about the medical benefits of psychedelics, which are a key puzzle piece in correcting this stigma. The first thing you need to know about the medical aspects of psychedelics is that they have very, very low toxicity levels and are generally very safe. They are not addictive, and in fact, they are anti-addictive, which means that they cure addictions, which means that they are self-correcting, in that if you do too many psychedelics, basically, they themselves will tell you to stop to do psychedelics. So the lethal potential of psychedelics, many of them like LSD, mushrooms, and so on, is so low that you couldn't even possibly consume a lethal dose. Almost impossible. You need to eat over 100 pounds of mushrooms to kill yourself. you would need to eat over 1,000 tabs or doses of LSD to kill yourself. Whereas if you take a look at aspirin or caffeine or even water, you can kill yourself with just drinking too much water. If you drink a couple of gallons of water straight down, you can kill yourself. And people have died from that. If you consume too many aspirins, a couple of bottles too much, you'll kill yourself. That's not the case with most psychedelics. Now, does this mean that psychedelics are perfectly safe and that dosages are irrelevant? No, not at all. You can certainly freak yourself out on psychedelics. They can certainly destabilize you mentally and psychologically if you take too much of a dose that you're not prepared to handle. And that can be a pretty traumatic experience. So dosages are still important. There's still potential for abuse with psychedelics. I'm not saying there's not, but you have to take into account that there's potential for abuse with almost everything. You can abuse a car, you can abuse a gun, you can abuse potato chips, you can abuse ice cream, you can kill yourself with food. So, yes, realistically, there's a risk with everything. What we need to do is we need to find a balance. And what I'm saying is that our culture is totally out of whack. We have swung our pendulum so much to one direction that we have disconnected ourselves from our own origins, from nature, from herbalism, and from spirituality. And instead, what we do is we come up with all these antidepressants and Ritalin for our kids because they're stuck on ADHD mode all the time and they're, you know, they're running around frantically. They can't focus. And as it turns out, these antidepressants and this Ritalin and stuff, this is more addictive than psychedelics. And it's actually proven to have less effect than psychedelics. So let's now talk about the medically proven amazing results that psychedelics have been shown to have. Perhaps the most amazing evidence we have coming in is when it comes to addiction. It has been clinically demonstrated now in numerous studies and in numerous clinical practices that iboga, mushrooms, LSD, DMT, ayahuasca, that these have powerful anti-addictive properties and that these actually are the most effective tool for curing people of heroin addiction, cocaine addiction, smoking addiction, and alcohol addiction. Did you know that the founder of AA broke his addiction to alcohol, not through the 12 steps primarily, but through LSD? He did it because he took LSD, and actually LSD was one of the key ingredients in his 12-step program. But of course, the government outlawed LSD, and so he had to remove it from his program. And so now AA has been defanged. The most important element of AA, the LSD, has been removed. And that is truly the most important element, because LSD and DMT and mushrooms, these have been shown to work exceptionally well for people who have alcohol addiction. More effective than almost anything else. In particular, ibogaine is the most promising case here. It's a very, very powerful psychedelic, and it has very special properties that are very helpful with addiction. And it's particularly effective for heroin addicts, as also is 5-MeO-DMT, because it's also very, very powerful. Now, why do psychedelics have this anti-addictive properties? Is it just because you take a magic pill and then some chemical mumbo-jumbo happens in your body and then all of a sudden you're free? Not quite. Iboga has a little bit of that going on, but there's an even important element. The most important element of the psychedelic is that it raises your consciousness. It makes you more aware. It gives you the ability to self-reflect in an unbiased way about your own life and to see where you're fucking up and what your neuroses are. And sure enough, people who are addicted to crack and heroin and meth and all this kind of stuff and alcohol, the reason they're addicted is not just because they're addicted. They're addicted because they have fucked up lives. They were abused. They were neglected. They were bullied in school. They were molested. You know, they faced all violence, gangs, all this kind of stuff, which then made them so psychologically neurotic and screwed up that they needed some crutch, and they found their crutch to be heroin or some other kind of drug. But then, of course, that doesn't solve the problem. That just makes the problem worse. So what the ibogaine or the 5-MeO-DMT can do is it can get you to look back at your life with consciousness and then to work through that stuff in a very, well, effortless way. You could say in one sense it's effortless, in another sense it's not effortless. Is you can reflect on that stuff and then you can gain a sort of conscious traction over it to the point where you can just let it go. And there has been an amazing success rate with ibogaine and with 5-MeO-DMT for curing heroin addicts. These are hardcore addicts who've been living on the streets for 10 to 20 years, and they've tried all sorts of cures that have not worked for them. But when they try iboga or 5-MeO, they have a 50% success rate of quitting and never coming back to heroin, which is amazing if you know anything about this field. So for addictions, these substances are amazing. And the reason they're amazing is because they raise your consciousness. And as I've talked about in my addiction episodes, and I've talked about elsewhere, you know, what is human growth? What is personal development? What is it all about? It's about becoming more conscious. The more conscious you become, the less neurotic you are, the less you overthink. And this helps with addictions. This helps with depression, with anxiety, with PTSD, with autism, with relationship problems, with anger problems, with all of this. And right now we have study after study coming out, which is showing exactly this. We have clinical evidence that's showing that psychedelics are very effective against depression, more so than anti-depression medication. And they are not as unhealthy as antidepressant medication. Antidepressant medication has all sorts of side effects. It's also very addictive. You can't just stop it. You have to gradually wean yourself off. Otherwise, you have suicide risks, all this kind of nasty stuff. You don't have any of that with psychedelics. And they're more effective against depression. Why is that? Because it raises your consciousness, opens your perspective, gets you unstuck from your shadow and from your ego. It's also proven to be effective with social anxiety. It's proven to be very effective against PTSD when other treatments don't work. Right now, mushrooms and MDMA and LSD are being tested on guys from coming back from the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan who have PTSD, and it's proving very effective for them there, to the point where we're looking at having actually a legalization of these substances for curing specifically PTSD in clinical settings. These substances are proven to work to help with autism, with end of life, for example, cancer patients who are going through terrible chemotherapy and pain and fear about the prospect of dying, and then the mushrooms or the LSD or the MDMA can help with that. MDMA is very effective for solving marriage problems and relationship counseling that would otherwise end in divorce. Helpful against anger problems and basically any neurosis you can imagine. Again, why is that? Because we're raising consciousness. When you raise consciousness, all that shit gets auto-corrected. That's how it works. There are a lot of amazing researchers today working in this field. These are serious. These aren't just hippies and new agers. These are serious academics, serious scientists, serious PhDs. One example that I'll give you is Rick Doblin, who runs the MAPS program. It's a nonprofit organization which has been running for over 20 years that works closely with the U.S. government to get approval from the FDA for clinical treatments, legal clinical treatments using LSD, MDMA, mushrooms, and ibogaine for clinical cases of depression, anxiety, addiction, PTSD, and so on. And right now, they are in the process of doing trials, proving to the FDA that these techniques work scientifically with double-blind controlled studies, repeating them very carefully. And it looks like in the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to have a lot of breakthroughs, and some of these clinical techniques will be approved and legalized in the U.S. But of course, there are other countries besides the U.S. For example, ibogaine clinics are proving very successful in Canada, Mexico, and Costa Rica, where they are legal. In the U.S., ibogaine is a Schedule 1 substance, I believe, so it's not legal here. There are no clinics here. But these clinics in Canada and in Mexico and Costa Rica are having amazing results with hardcore addicts. And in fact, if you have a friend who is a hardcore addict or even just addicted to alcohol, and you see that he is killing himself slowly with his smoking or his alcohol, tell him about Ibogaine clinics. Tell him that it's worth his time. Pay a couple $1,000, fly to Canada, fly to Mexico, fly to Costa Rica, do a week-long retreat there with this Ibogaine. It will change your life forever, and you'll kick these addictions in a way that you never imagined possible. That's real. You can do that right now. You can research that online and find these clinics. I'll also mention Dr. Octavio Rettig, R-E-T-T-I-G, who is a world-famous medicine man and shaman from Mexico. In Mexico, actually, 5-MeO-DMT is legal for clinical use. And so what he has pioneered is the gathering of toad venom from the Bufalvarius toad, which contains 5-MeO-DMT and bufotenin in its glands and in the venom that it has, and they extract it, and then you can smoke it, and you can have very powerful trips with 5-MeO-DMT and bufotenin in there. And this guy himself, Octavio Rettig, he used to be a heroin addict for many years, and the only thing that worked for him is smoking this toad venom. So he smoked this toad venom, he turned his life around, he became a real doctor. He has an MD, and now he is an ambassador for the UN, and he has traveled to over 90 countries around the world, providing this treatment of the toad venom. He collects it, and then he helps people to smoke it in a sort of ritual setting, one-on-one sessions and small group sessions. And he's had amazing success, literally provided it to thousands of hardcore addicts, and treated them in Mexico and everywhere around the world. I've actually had a guy on my forum who heard me talking about Octavio Rettig, and then he actually bumped into him in Europe and drove down there, did the experience, said it was amazing. And so that's one example that I have. I'm sure others have done it, but that's the one that I've gotten kind of a testimonial back from. Pretty cool. So he's getting amazing results with his work. There's also the work of Stanislav Grof, who was a pioneer with LSD research. He was an MD and a psychiatrist and a psychologist who worked in the 50s and 60s, and he's still alive today, and he's done a lot of work showing just how effective LSD and these kind of psychedelics can be for psychotherapeutic purposes. And also another guy along that line is Ralph Metzner, who is a Harvard PhD and a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and he has also worked and done a clinical practice where he provided 5-MeO-DMT and LSD and other substances, and did it in a psychotherapeutic context and has gotten amazing results there. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I could stand here and talk for hours and hours about all these amazing guys doing amazing research, both clinically and scientifically. Right now, you got to understand this is a totally cutting-edge field. This field has only existed for about 60 to 70 years, since the 1950s. And psychedelics have been outlawed for research purposes in the U.S. for most of that time, since the late 60s and early 70s. So if the research was not being blocked for the last 40 years, we would have a lot more research. But nevertheless, there are still courageous and intrepid pioneer researchers out there doing this research, both in the U.S. and in other countries. And so stuff is changing, and we're discovering more and more and more about the amazing, powerful effects of these substances. And I'm sure that over the next 10 to 20 years, you're going to see a lot more research coming out that's going to just add on top of this pile of everything that I'm saying here. So that's the medical piece of the puzzle. Pretty freaking big. Pretty important. Think about all the people we have addicted to opioids. Right now, we're talking about the opioid epidemic in the U.S. Well, a lot of that could be alleviated if we had a proper system of distribution of psychedelics and a proper context and culture about how to use them. And that's not to mention all the other addictions that we don't even call addictions in our society. People are addicted to porn, people are addicted to internet, to their cell phones, to sex, to all this sort of stuff. And these psychedelics will help with all of that, not just with heroin addiction. Think about how much of a boost in consciousness a substance like Iboga or 5-MeO would have to give a person to get them to quit heroin like that, cold turkey? That's fucking amazing. That's a testament to how big of a shift in consciousness you can have. So if it can do that for a heroin addict, imagine what it could do for you as a not heroin addict. Because you're still struggling with all the same basic life problems of a heroin addict. I mean, for a heroin addict, his problems are just a little bit worse. But you still have those same problems. You don't like how you look. You have social anxiety. You're too introverted. You have OCD. You have ADHD. You have various fears and quirks and all this sort of stuff. And you procrastinate. You do all this sort of stuff. And you're addicted to all of it. And you don't know how to fix yourself. That's what personal development is here for. But then again, you do this personal development and it's so tough and it's a grind and it's difficult and you don't really know how to have an enlightenment experience. You keep trying, but you're not having one. Well, that's the perfect place where a substance like 5-MeO or mushrooms can come in and just give you a little nudge in the right direction. They are a catalyst. It's important to understand that I'm not saying they're a replacement for spiritual practices. They're not a replacement for personal development. They're not a replacement for reading and listening to audiobooks and for eating healthy and all that kind of stuff. They are a catalyst. They are one tool in your toolbox. So, of course, I talked about the ancient uses of psychedelics, but you should realize that we have all these modern uses of psychedelics. In Peru and in Brazil, today you can do ayahuasca and yopo. And people are doing it, both natives and Westerners, and they're having amazing results. And, you know, they're not becoming criminals. Their mind is not going insane. These substances are not, you know, destroying families there. We have various churches, actually, in the U.S. We have the Santo Daime Church and the UDV Church, which are the only two churches that I'm aware of which have a legal right to provide DMT in the form of ayahuasca to their followers, because they actually had big court cases. The UDV church case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that they are allowed to consume ayahuasca, but only them and Santo Daime in certain states. So you can actually join these churches and drink ayahuasca, and they do that legally, and they're having success with that, and they actually give it to their kids to drink. Give it to their teenagers to drink, not just adults. Of course, Native Americans to this day are doing peyote ceremonies, and they involve their teenagers in that. In Mexico, natives do mushroom ceremonies today. In Mexico, Octavio Retig is doing these 5-MeO ceremonies today, legally, and it's working great. In Mexico and Canada, Costa Rica, we have these Ibogaine clinics, and they're working great, and they are legal there. In Africa, the Bwiti tribe uses iboga to this day, and it works great for them. In Nepal, to this day, they use datura. Various yogis and saints, they have a secret cult there for using datura. In India, also, they use hashish and marijuana in various ways as well. The yogis do. Not just guys who are hippies. These are serious, hardcore mystics. And they are transforming themselves and transforming the lives of everybody around them by increasing their consciousness through these substances, which is not to say they don't abuse them. I'm sure some of them abuse them as well. You can read the works of Carlos Castaneda, which talks about modern day uses of these psychedelics. So it's just not true that these substances are not possible to use responsibly. They are being used responsibly all over the world with great success, with enormous success, but most people just don't know about it. And this is stuff you don't hear about in mainstream culture. So this concludes episode part one. We're going to have a part two and maybe even a part three, because there's so much information here. And even this episode turned out to be very long. But this is sort of like an information dump. I'm dumping all this stuff on you so you can kind of just jump into the deep end and just start to see, like, oh my God, there's so much stuff that I wasn't taught. All this factual information, you can go and follow up, and I encourage you to go follow up on this, read the books, get an encyclopedia, start reading this stuff. There's so much information there. Browse around online. start to notice how this stigma that you have about, around psychedelics just starts to dissolve in light of all the hard scientific evidence and all the anthropological evidence that we have and all the psychological evidence. And then, of course, to really cinch the deal, you got to go try it yourself. And then you will prove to yourself beyond a shadow of a doubt that this stigma is completely ass backwards. All right, that's it for this one. Please remember to click that like button. Go check out actualize.org. Check out my blog. Check out the forum. Check out the Life Purpose course. Check out the book list. I have books there about psychedelics, and I'll be adding more in the future. And just stick around for the next episode so that we can conclude this entire train of thought. There's still a lot of stuff, very juicy stuff that I want to say on this topic, but that will be coming next week.